Before ether and chloroform, surgery was a brutal business. The London surgeon Robert Liston could take your leg off in a couple of minutes, but working at such a speed could lead to accidents. During one amputation, a swift movement of Liston's blade accidentally removed the patient's testicles along with his leg. In another, he amputated his assistant's fingers and slashed a spectator's coat. The patient and the assistant both died from infection, and the spectator reportedly dropped dead from shock. Whether this operation really did have a 300% mortality, it illustrates the point that anaesthesia didn't just benefit the patients. Jon Snow had realised that anaesthesia induced unconsciousness, but it also stopped patients moving, meaning surgeons could start to take their time, and that allowed surgery to transform into the specialty we know today. Anaesthesia has advanced too, but when it comes to inhaled anaesthetics, the gases might be different, but the principles are almost exactly the same. The debate over whether chloroform could kill by causing the heart to stop beating had raged for decades, and commission after commission had failed to convince some doctors that chloroform-induced cardiac syncope existed. My name is Matthew Herron, and this is Ether Or. It's the story of the history of anaesthesia, the gases we once used to put people to sleep, and how the safety of patients became central to a modern speciality. In 1911, doctors would finally get an answer about the dangers of chloroform, and as new inhaled anaesthetics were discovered, doctors would look for ways to objectively compare them, and they'd discover new 21st century problems. Chloroform had secured great popularity, almost from the moment it was introduced. Its benefits over ether were so great that even when patients had started dying, doctors hadn't given it up. Chloroform could stop you breathing if you had too much, everyone agreed on that, but doctors were divided on whether chloroform could suddenly stop your heart beating, something they called cardiac syncope. The committees and commissions that had revisited and re-examined the problem from the 1860s to the 1890s couldn't come to a consensus, and the debate had dragged on, with Scottish doctors telling the English that if they'd only give chloroform like they did, they wouldn't have a problem. They hadn't seen any of these cardiac deaths, or if they had, they hadn't recognised them as that. The threat of a chloroform-induced cardiac arrest hung over doctors like some spectral apparition, but only the English seemed able to see it. In some parts of the world, chloroform was given up entirely, but in the UK, doctors seemed wedded to it completely, as Dr. Christine Ball, anaesthetist and Wood Library Museum of Anaesthesiology laureate, explains.
Okay, so chloroform, as you say, came along at the end of 1847. And I think part of what the reasons chloroform was so popular initially was because it was so different to ether. I've never tried it or given it to anybody, but apparently it's really pleasant to inhale and quite a rapid induction. So you can see why it was instantly fairly popular, because people had realised anaesthesia was possible, but ether wasn't great, you know. So chloroform really was a bit of a magic solution. The story right through the whole of the 19th century is lots of things were written and lots of things were done, but everyone kept using chloroform. And that's probably the great mystery, really. I mean, it really must be a great drug compared to ether, because that's just what happened. There was very sort of compartmentalised anaesthesia. I suppose in London, you know, they were using a lot of chloroform. They were being quite scientific about it. In Scotland, they were giving it completely differently, and they really thought it was safe. And they were saying they weren't seeing deaths. In places like America, they pretty much stopped using chloroform and went back to ether.
Doctors in Scotland, convinced it was safe, carried on giving chloroform the same way they always had, poured on a cloth held to the face. In London, they placed a finger on the pulse to help them detect cardiac syncope, and they used inhalers to prevent an overdose. Whatever you believed, dosing chloroform was a fine balance. Too little, and the patient wouldn't be adequately anaesthetised. Too much, and their breathing or their heart might stop. The problem of how much or how little to give was easy to see. But how do you dose a gas? How do you compare them? And how do you know when you've given enough? To put it simply, when we give you an anaesthetic today, how do we know you're not aware? In 1990, the American anesthesiologist Edmund Ted Eger gave an interview as part of the Wood Library Museum of Anesthesiology's Living History Project. Ted died in 2017, but it was his research into inhaled anesthetics that underpins everything we know about them and how we use them today. Early in his research career, Ted was asked to evaluate a new anesthetic called halopropane, and he realized that there was no good objective way of comparing the effects of different anesthetic vapors.
And the first question that we raised was, how are we going to study this? And we can measure things ventilatory or things circulatory, but how do we connect that to the anesthetic? And how do we connect the anesthetic to other anesthetics? How do we make comments about the comparability or the difference between this new anesthetic and any anesthetic that we were presently using?
The key to the problem was in the alveoli, the tiny functional units of the lungs where gas exchange with the blood occurs. Eger deduced that if the amount of carbon dioxide in the alveoli was roughly equal to the amount in the blood, then that must also be true of an anesthetic that a patient inhaled. If the amount of anesthetic measured in the alveoli was equal to the amount in the blood, that would be the same as how much got to the brain to have an effect. But how do you measure the concentration of a gas in the alveoli to tell you how much is in the brain? It was actually easier than you might think. At the end of a normal, tidal breath, the last fraction of gas we breathe out is the gas expelled from the alveoli, and we call that the end tidal gas. That fraction of alveolar gas can be sampled as you breathe it out, and the concentrations of gases contained within it can be measured. That allowed Ted Eger to develop a unit of potency that would allow him to compare different inhaled anesthetic agents.
And we married that notion, which was prevalent, with the notion of anesthesia, some simple notion of anesthesia. And the simple notion of anesthesia as something that suppresses movement had been around for a long time. In fact, I have a quotation from John Snow back in 1847 that says that ether does things besides preventing pain. It suppresses movement in patients. I'm paraphrasing that. I think he said it more elegantly than I can. And I happen to be presented with the need to develop some concept that made use of these notions that already existed. And the result was the notion that you could measure an end-tidal concentration as representative of the partial pressure of anesthetic in the brain, and that you could have some simple measure of anesthetic effect, movement or absence of movement. And you use the alveolar concentration to define the potency of the anesthetic as a function of whether the animal moved or did not move in response to some noxious stimulus. So that was the genesis of MAC.
Eger took an observable effect of inhaled anesthetics, the suppression of movement in response to surgery, and he paired it with the idea that the amount of anesthetic measured at the end of expiration was equal to the amount in the brain. Using those ideas, he calculated the minimum concentration of different anesthetic agents that was needed in the alveoli to suppress movement in response to surgery.
The term MAC was coined because we've been talking about the minimum concentration or minimum alveolar anesthetic concentration. And someone said that's MOC or MAC, and we all agreed that that was a great acronym. So minimum alveolar concentration of anesthetic required to eliminate movement in 50% of animals or humans.
The lower the MAC, the more potent the agent, because you needed a lower concentration to achieve the same effect. Chloroform had a MAC of 0.5, about 6 times less than the MAC of ether, which explained why doctors needed so much less. But MAC gave us much more than a way to compare anesthetic potency. Today we use the concept of MAC to dose inhaled anesthetics and guide the depth of anesthesia. Movement doesn't necessarily equate to awareness, but thanks to John Snow, we know that a deeply anesthetized patient won't move in response to a surgical stimulus. Thanks to Ted Eger, we know how much inhaled anesthetic we have to give to achieve anesthesia deep enough to suppress movement. For doctors using ether and chloroform in the 19th century, their patient was their only guide, as this 1944 video from the Wellcome Library describing anesthesia with ether shows.
The chief guide during induction of anesthesia is the breathing. With loss of consciousness, it alters, becoming irregular, deeper, and often noisy. It'll usually take 10 minutes to reach the second stage of anesthesia. Don't look at the eyes, or you may disturb the patient if she's not quite off. But this is what they would look like. The pupils very variable, usually small, and the eyes roving from side to side with a divergent squint. After another 5 minutes or so, there's a fairly sudden change to regular, so-called automatic breathing, which shows that she's down to the third stage of surgical anesthesia. You'll find the eyes fixed and central, with small pupils. The patient is now ready for operation. Listen always to the breathing. Any alteration in the automatic rhythm may be due to surgical stimuli in light anesthesia, or, as in this case, to a change in depth of anesthesia.
In the 19th century, Ted Eger's work was still half a century away, so doctors had to make do with clinical signs to estimate how deeply anesthetized their patient was, and how they gave chloroform would influence how quickly anesthesia was induced. While Scotland had continued to give chloroform on a cloth, doctors in London were so anxious about the dual risks of overdose that they'd keep a finger on the pulse and watch the breathing while they slowly and progressively induced chloroform anesthesia with inhalers to limit the dose. The slower they gave chloroform, the quicker they could pull it away if the breathing or the pulse changed. The Scottish method meant patients might inhale higher concentrations of chloroform, but that meant they'd induce deep anesthesia quicker. Their critics argued that this placed their patients in greater danger. But in Scotland, they weren't worried about overdose causing cardiac syncope, maybe because they induced anesthesia so quickly that they missed the signs. Or maybe they just didn't see as many cases. It was complicated, because not everyone who was given chloroform died, and healthy patients seemed to be most at risk. Doctors had also noticed that the early stages of anesthesia seemed to be more dangerous. Once you'd got the patient off to sleep, the danger seemed to be over, and chloroform's contradictions underpinned the whole debate. Almost 65 years after chloroform anesthesia had been introduced, they'd finally get an answer that would prove that when it came to chloroform, overdose wasn't the only problem. Alfred Goodman Levy had been the resident anaesthetist at Guy's Hospital in London in 1903. His interest in chloroform had led him to conduct experiments in cats in 1911, but the results he saw didn't seem to fit with the theory that an overdose of chloroform could cause the heart to suddenly stop beating. Now, updating his colleagues in 1914, he explained how in cats anaesthetized with chloroform, he had seen how the ventricles would, in certain circumstances, begin to beat at a rate of up to 330 times a minute. Sometimes the heart would return to a normal rhythm, but sometimes these abnormally rapid heartbeats, or extrasystoles, developed into ventricular fibrillation, a fatal abnormal heart rhythm, and the cat would almost instantaneously be dead.
What is ventricular fibrillation? Let me say at once that we have not at present a distinct conception of its intimate nature. But we are aware that ineffectual ventricular contractions of the heart succeed one another at a very rapid rate, and the function of the ventricles is entirely abolished. Its clinical manifestation is therefore a sudden vascular collapse and consequent instantaneous death. By taking proper precautions, it is possible to induce and maintain chloroform anesthesia in an animal such as a cat without a single extrasystole making its appearance. Although chloroform renders the ventricles liable to exhibit these abnormal contractions, it does not itself excite them directly. There must be another and distinct exciting cause. The exciting cause of the extrasystole is some form of cardiac stimulation.
Chloroform itself didn't seem to cause ventricular fibrillation, he explained, but it did make it more likely to occur if the heart was subsequently stimulated. The experiments he performed in cats had used varying concentrations of chloroform to induce light and deep anesthesia, and then he'd injected them with adrenaline. In lightly anesthetized cats, he saw how they would develop a rapid heartbeat before they deteriorated into ventricular fibrillation, or VF, and died. But an injection of adrenaline hadn't caused VF in cats deeply anesthetized with chloroform, or in cats who received ether. Light chloroform anesthesia specifically seemed to predispose the heart to developing VF, but some inciting event also had to occur to stimulate it.
I will now describe some of the forms of cardiac stimulation which are liable to produce a fatal reaction in the lightly chloroformed animal. Stimulation by accelerator impulses originating in the central nervous system, such as may accompany the subconscious emotional state. Or stimulation by accelerator impulses originating from the excitation of sensory nerves induced by mild forms of sensory excitation, such as cutting the skin.
Levy theorized that the reflex secretion of a patient's own adrenaline during light chloroform anesthesia could be enough to induce VF in a heart now sensitized to adrenaline's effects. After all the debates, it wasn't too much chloroform that was the problem, but too little. The combination of light chloroform anesthesia that would sensitize the heart, coupled with a burst of adrenaline to trigger a fatal arrhythmia. His theory explained why the intermediate stages of anesthesia seemed to be more dangerous, and looking back at Hannah Greener, whose death under chloroform had begun the whole debate, the clues were there from the very beginning.
January 1848, which was really only a couple of months after Simpson had discovered chloroform anesthesia, Hannah Greener, who was a young girl having a toenail removed, inhaled some chloroform. And I think before they'd really, the operation was just removal of the toenail, but I think while they were doing that, she just died. And she had expressed a lot of reluctance to inhale chloroform. She'd previously had an ether anesthetic for, I think, a similar procedure, and she'd hated it. So she didn't want another anesthetic, but she also didn't want a painful procedure. So she was already in a state of heightened anxiety.
Hannah's doctor had noticed, as he began the administration of chloroform, that her pulse suddenly became very fast and then felt very weak. As the surgery had started, Hannah had jerked in her chair. John Snow's observation that deep anesthesia suppresses movement suggests that Hannah was in a light plane of anesthesia. The adrenaline released due to her anxiety and the painful stimulation of surgery starting too soon had been enough to throw her heart into ventricular fibrillation. Just 2 minutes after the inhalation had started, she was dead.
She inhaled the chloroform and was dead before the operation was finished. So within 2 or 3 minutes of starting the inhalation of chloroform, she died. So they did what they could, which was very little in those days. There was very little in the way of resuscitation techniques. They threw cold water in her face. They poured brandy down her throat that apparently she swallowed, but she was dead. At the time, they thought she died of fright. I think there was a genuine feeling that she was so scared that that's what had killed her. And that was certainly something that was perpetuated over the following months. As people started to die from chloroform, they really did think some of them had died of fright. And I guess that sort of makes sense because in a way they had. You know, we know now that light chloroform anesthesia combined with anxiety will cause VF, but they didn't know that.
Levy's work had shown how a patient lightly anesthetized with chloroform, not conscious, but not so deeply anaesthetized as to be unresponsive to surgery, was in a perilous position. And it explained the differences in experiences between London and Edinburgh too. Levy agreed that limiting the dose of chloroform was important to keep the patient breathing. But in London, the fixation on the dangers of overdose had led to another risk. As they gradually induced anaesthesia, believing this was safer as it allowed them to closely monitor the breathing and pulse, their patients spent longer in the intermediate stages of anaesthesia, where paradoxically, a fatal cardiac arrhythmia was more likely to occur. In Scotland, they confidently and quickly induced deep chloroform anaesthesia, with larger amounts of chloroform on a cloth. So bizarrely, their refusal to accept that cardiac syncope even existed may have protected their patients, because they achieved deep anaesthesia quicker.
An essential part of my theory is the fact that deaths by ventricular fibrillation occur only in the lightly anaesthetized subject, and hence it stands in clear contrast with the accepted explanation of death under chloroform by overdosage. The theory of death by overdosage has, in my opinion, been a most deplorable one for humanity. I would urge those who still continue to lay exaggerated stress upon the risk of death by overdosage that they assume a grave public responsibility in regard to the perpetuation of chloroform fatalities.
Doctors in Scotland had been right that too much chloroform didn't cause cardiac syncope. But doctors in London were correct when they asserted that cardiac syncope under chloroform did in fact exist, even if their method of giving it made it more likely. The question of chloroform-induced cardiac syncope had finally been answered, and doctors on both sides of the argument could say that they were correct. James Young Simpson had discovered chloroform, but his son wondered in 1889 why doctors had spent so much time comparing the relative safety of ether and chloroform, when according to him, statistically speaking, the percentage of deaths was so small as to be practically nil. By 1934, chloroform's dangers would be laid out in the German surgeon Hans Killian's retrospective analysis, which found that fatal complications under ether were between 1 in 14,000 and 1 in 28,000, compared to chloroform's mortality rate of 1 in 3,000 to 1 in 6,000. Chloroform was undeniably dangerous, but it would still take time for doctors to give it up completely. Levy made recommendations in 1914 for the safer use of chloroform, but it would gradually be replaced as new agents were developed, all based on ether and all characterized by Ted Eger. And as anaesthesia develops through its second century, new issues with the gases we use are being debated.
We have instruments located at various places in the world, and they do continuous measurements, meaning one measurement every 2 hours or so. And then we end up with a little tiny sample of highly concentrated compounds that we then measure by gas chromatography and mass spectrometry. So those are the in situ measurements that we conduct. Like, for example, we measure those at the Jungfraujoch, that's a high altitude, a famous tourist site in Switzerland. We have a station there where we have been making measurements for almost 2 decades now.
Ted Eger had sampled gas from the lungs in his research into the uptake, distribution, and potency of inhaled anaesthetics. Now climate scientists like Martin Vollmer from the Swiss Federal Laboratories for Material Science and Technology are sampling the air high up in the Swiss Alps, and they can measure anaesthetic gases even at 3,500 meters. Perched at the top of Europe, the Sphinx Observatory, crowned with the mirrored dome that houses its telescope, is also home to the equipment Martin and his team use to sample atmospheric air to measure trace gases that contribute to climate change. Gases like isoflurane, sevoflurane, and desflurane, the anaesthetic agents we use today.
we looked at the four all at once, we knew that halothane was used in the past, in the 50s, 60s, and then gradually disappeared from usage. So we thought, oh, we would like to look at that too, because halothane is a molecule that contains bromine, and bromine is a very strong ozone depleter in the stratosphere. So that was the incentive. And then we looked at that together with the fluoranes. Global warming potential, on one hand, is the strength at which it absorbs infrared radiation. So the potential on how strongly it warms up the atmosphere. And that's a relative unit that we use compared to CO2 on a mass basis, on a per kilogram basis. And a lot of these compounds, particularly desflurane, has a very high global warming potential. It's about 2,500. So that means 1 kilogram of desflurane has about the same effect as 2,500 kilograms of CO2 put into the atmosphere. And so that's why we talk about potent greenhouse gases. Halothane is much less, and sevoflurane also. Isoflurane has, I think, about a GWP of 500. Connected to that a little bit is also the atmospheric lifetime. That's basically the time a compound resides in the atmosphere. If you were to put a whole bunch of these compounds out into the atmosphere, how long does it take until it disappears, or until half of it disappears? And that's the atmospheric lifetime. And for that, desflurane is the compound that has the highest lifetime. It's about 14 years. So in other words, it stays for a rather long time in the atmosphere.
The trends Martin has observed show an increase in the use of desflurane, which is the most recently introduced inhaled anesthetic. And although the amounts of anesthetic gases detected in atmospheric air samples are measured in parts per trillion, the global warming potential of the agents means their impact is significant.
There's a bit of a community who fights all these fluoranes, or inhalation and anesthetics, for various reasons, environmental reasons, like, you know, what we've found, the impact on global warming. And for cost reasons, apparently desflurane is exorbitantly expensive. Jody Sherman in the US, she's working in anesthesia, and she's very active in trying to ban these fluoranes, particularly desflurane. And there are papers out too who say, you know, desflurane should disappear, things like that.
The environmental implications of inhaled anesthetics and what to do about them are being widely debated. But it's a problem healthcare needs to consider more widely, from providing infrastructure to encourage active transport to and from hospitals, to the amount of waste hospitals produce, and how hospitals get rid of it. We've used inhaled anesthetics since the birth of modern anesthesia, but what their role will be in the future is up for debate. When Ted Eger was interviewed in 1990 for the Wood Library Museum of Anesthesia's Living History Project, he was asked about his predictions for the future of anesthesia.
I'd say that the future will hold the development of new agents, both in the field of inhaled anesthesia and in the field of other drug administrations. The new agents, as far as I can tell for the immediate future, will be those that produce their effects in a more controllable fashion. But what we'd like to have, perhaps, is not something we will have, which will be agents in the inhaled arena that will not produce the depression that we're used to today. We'd like to have something perhaps like ether, but I don't think we're apt to find that. So I think we're going to have to be content with agents that will be developed that will produce anesthesia very quickly and controllably, more controllably and quickly than today, will be easy to breathe, will have all of the positive attributes of today's agents, and a few, if any, of their negative attributes.
I suppose if we were asking that question today, we would add minimal environmental impact to his list as well. As chloroform's dangers were finally realised, doctors would return to ether and nitrous oxide. The principles they used to develop their ether and chloroform inhalers would form the foundation for the modern anaesthetic machines, where a fresh gas supply flows over a vapour source to carry the anaesthetic to the patient. The equipment today looks modern, but the ideas are not. It's striking to me too that when asked about new inhaled anaesthetic agents, Ted Eger turned his thoughts to ether, that anaesthetic so maligned by chloroform's advocates that it was unfashionable even when chloroform was killing people. Today the gases we use have changed, but as we move towards the 200th anniversary of William Morton's 1846 ether demonstration, we're still tackling the problems that come hand in hand with using gases and vapours as drugs. Anesthesia had been a contradiction almost since its very origin. It was a humanitarian triumph, and the men who gave it to the world were heralded as the greatest benefactors of the human race. And yet, with chloroform's introduction, anesthesia had also brought a steady stream of deaths alongside the alleviation of suffering. 175 years after the first demonstration of surgical anesthesia, the legacy of that history is still all around us. Chloroform has left us with a subconscious anxiety about the consequences of our actions, and a speciality that tries to assess and interrogate the safety of what we do. Today in anesthesia, we're not immune to some of the same problems and pitfalls of our predecessors. We're still wondering about where the risks in anesthesia lie and what we can do to minimize them. Chloroform's risks forced a transformation in how doctors thought about anesthesia, and it was out of risk that the modern speciality was born. But it's William Morton's ether demonstration that's remembered, recreated, and reimagined by artists ever since. It's from ether that we've inherited the inhaled anesthetics we use now, and it's the problems of ether's descendants that we're now trying to solve. We certainly don't have all the answers, and we can't be sure that anaesthetists in another 175 years won't look at the issues we're grappling with today and wonder why we didn't do anything about them. But engaging with the history of anesthesia enriches the conversation we can have about anesthesia's future, and it makes us think harder about the problems we're trying to solve today. And that's why, for me at least, ether and chloroform still matter. Thanks to Dr. Christine Ball and Dr. Martin Vollmer for their expertise. The voice of Alfred Goodman Levy was provided by Max Dowler. The extracts from Dr. Edmund Ted Eger's interview were courtesy of the Wood Library Museum of Anesthesiology. You can watch the interview in full on their website, woodlibrarymuseum.org. The audio you heard describing ether anesthesia was courtesy of the Wellcome Library. You can find more information about the risks of anesthesia from the website of the Royal College of Anaesthetists, rcoa.ac.uk. Our music was composed by Nicola Chang, and this episode was written, recorded, and edited by me, Matthew Herron. Please rate, review, and subscribe to Ether All. It helps other people find the show. Thanks for listening.